Jane Oates is here on the Noon Business Lunch, the policy advisor, former president of Working Nation. Thanks for joining us again, Jane. How have you been?
I heard that good weather report for Chicago.
How about that?
It's going to be a happy weekend for you guys.
What do you make of the January job report?
You know, mixed messages, right? I mean, top line that everybody's in the administration is touting is, you know, adding 130,000 jobs, which is so much more than most economists thought. But the hidden message is the revision for 2025. I mean, that was frightening. They revised the whole year job number down that we only, you know, by so much that we only, looks like we only added 187,000 jobs in all of 2025. That's a frightening number.
And most of them were in the last couple of months, as I recall, and it's a revision from over a million, right?
That's exactly right. I mean, it was really frightening. I mean, the revisions kept coming last year, but this revision of 400,000 at one time, just amazing for the whole year. I mean, and you know what, John? I don't know how your network is, but in my network, that really mirrors kitchen table conversations much more than adding jobs. Everybody is complaining about how hard it is to find a job, how long they're looking. I mean, nobody's seeing this as a rosy, a rosy economy right now.
Except maybe the markets, they have hit record highs. I asked Terry Savage, the financial writer, about this on Wednesday, and I said, well, then why are the markets doing well? They're not doing great today, but I mean, we were over 50,000 for a few days here. And she said that's because the markets have a short attention span. They're not interested in the history. They're interested in where we're going. So whatever the hell happened in 2025, not many jobs created. They are optimistic about 26. Is that your read on it also?
You know, John, it's hard for me to be optimistic. I mean, when you have continuous months where sectors like financial services, you know, that's a great employer for so many people, whether bank tellers or financial managers at big houses. You know what I mean? That's a great job. That job, that financial service sector has not added a job since last May of 2025. And again, this month for January of 2026, lost another 22,000. That's a big hit. You know, I mean, we are so reliant on healthcare. I mean, of the 130,000 jobs added in January, 82,000 of them were in healthcare. That's not a healthy economy. We know what that's like even on a local level. You don't want to have all your eggs in one sector. This is really, I think it's a tough message going into 2026.
Next on that list after jobs created, number one was healthcare. Number two was social assist. I assume that means people working in assisted living facilities, that sort of thing?
People working in social services. So people who are working either in the nonprofit sector or the for-profit sector, helping people kinds of things. You know, the assisted living would come under healthcare. And I think in this number, in this month, of the 82,000, I think 10 or 12,000 were in residential care.
My folks are in residential care, and it's so expensive, and they also don't have enough people working there all the time. And I thought, well, what they could do is pay these people more. But it is so fantastic. So that will be inflationary, and yet it almost seems necessary because we're only going to get more and more folks aging into those facilities. There are fewer and fewer people that seem to want to do it. A lot of them are migrants, and we're making it difficult for those people to come in and work in this country. And if in order to get more people to take those jobs from wherever, you increase the pay, hokey smokes, we can't afford that. So that's the quandary for people like me right now.
Oh, so many people, John. We're all in that same boat, right? Long-term care is just bank busting. You know, I mean, it breaks your heart to see people who are struggling and choosing, you know, helping out with their parents rather than putting money away.
Well, so I'll just finish this thought. I share this frequently with my listeners, but only because I think it might be helpful to us all. So if my parents have to move to a facility where it has two people that can assist my dad, not just one, but my dad was 6'4", 220 pounds, strapping fella. And if it requires two people to help him up, he'll have to move to a facility that allows for two-person assist, they call it. We've looked at about four or five places lately. And the cost per month for my mom and dad to go to a place like that per month is going to be around $20,000 a month.
Oh, that's heartbreaking, John. I'm so sorry you're going through that. And all the listeners that are going through it.
Yeah.
I bet there's lots of people shaking their heads in their cars kitchens as they're listening to you.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, my dad worked in the public sector his whole life. He's got some pensions, and it looks like my folks will be able to afford this to their dying day. But wow, are we spending a lot of money on that care. Jane, what's your forecast then for the Fed right now?
Oh, jump ball, John, on that one. The bottom line is usually a good numbers day, you know, is not good for the interest rate coming down. So the question is, do they look at a plus 130 or do they look at 2025 numbers? I wouldn't want to be a board governor this month.
If I was guessing, I would say the trend is positive, but that they're not going to do anything until they get more data. Was that about right?
I think that's it. I think that I wouldn't want to make a decision this month.
Jane Oates, let's talk again soon. Jane, always a pleasure.
Love to talk, John. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Scott Stein is an editor-at-large at CNET. Scott, I want to talk to you about the new Galaxy product. How are you today?
Hey, good. How are you? Glad to be on again.
I saw the price on one of the Galaxy, the Trifold phone, that was like $2,800. Does that sound about right?
Yes, $2,899. It's a lot of money. It's like three phones.
I'm surprised there's a market for that, but that thing sold out, didn't it?
It did, and it kind of brings up, like, what exactly do people want in a phone right now, and how often are they upgrading? You know, there have been folding phones for a while, and Apple's reported to have its own folding phone that it may debut later this year. And the Trifold, it adds one more. So you have three panels that fold out, but now you're at the size of a tablet. And could that be something that you take with you? What cost do you do that? And that's what they're playing with there.
And is that the new product, or that's one that's already on the market? Catch me up.
So that is already on the market, but just came out the end of January. What's funny is that the event coming up, which is February 25th, doesn't sound like it's going to have a lot of exciting products. They're more like the mainstream phones. But it brings up this question, which phone is the new phone, really? And what types of phones do people want? Is it diffusing out so much that, you know, the idea of one phone event has kind of disappeared? Apple now has been splitting up its events, too.
They've always been able to make us believe that I need the new thing. I wonder if we get to a point where folks look at their phone and go, I don't need any more bells or whistles. This is all I can possibly manage.
Yeah, it looks like right now there are two big trends that I see. One is that cameras have been so improved across the board that I don't think getting new cameras always makes a huge impact for people because they might feel like mine's good enough. But adding these extra foldable parts, whether somebody wants to do that, I can see companies continuing to toy with that and play with that. The other side, which isn't even hardware, but it's AI, which is everywhere. But I think that the degree to which AI can transform your phone is still in flux. I think, you know, well, I'm really interested in what Google continues to do with Gemini on phones, but we're not going to get to hear about that until May, which is probably around May, which is when Google has its developer conference, that they tend to talk about all those new features that are going to be coming out. And Apple is working with Google on a Gemini partnership, but that looks like whatever they're cooking with that is being a little bit delayed, or we don't know when it's going to debut, but that could really change what happens on iPhones as well.
Can you give me an example of what we have or what we can expect, the integration of artificial intelligence with our smartphones? What features does that then create?
Well, one thing that has always interested me is the camera-connected AI. And not everybody wants that, but I think as an assistive element, some areas we're exploring that on glasses, but on your phone itself, the ability to recognize things, translate things, have awareness and help you, and almost use the camera as a scanner that the AI can then use to input data is very interesting to me. And then the other part that I'm still surprised is not on phones enough is just kind of smart functioning of all of the different files and features on your own phone. Not so much having it generate stuff out in the cloud, but more awareness and help to what's happening locally. And I think we're seeing some steps there, but it's really easy to get lost in all the features of a phone. And, you know, I would love a Siri or a Gemini to be that super assistant that knows where everything's at and gets you there faster so you're not fumbling around with all your apps.
So I'm talking to my phone or maybe just talking out loud, and my glasses have a built-in microphone, and now I have in my ear the smartest person in the world who can tell me where to drive, what to eat, who that person is, what the language is. I could be a walking computer myself, right?
Well, you could with limits. And so, you know, I think the question is, how much do you trust it? How much do you find it assistive? How much are we using that to extend what we already know versus kind of unconsciously going into this follow the AI mode? I find it most interesting to look at patterns in the data that I have, even more than trying to generate something for me.
Are you up to speed much on the integration of commercials into AI? So am I getting the information I want, or did somebody jump the queue and they paid for what I'm getting?
You mean in terms of commercials, like ads using AI, or in terms of
like I'm going to say to AI, hey, I'm in a new city. Where should I go to a restaurant? And rather than giving me the best reviewed restaurant at my price point because it knows how much money I spend and earn, it in fact gives me a restaurant that somebody paid for.
Yeah. Oh, that was the ads in AI. Yes. Yeah. So that's a big concern. You know, we're starting to see companies admitting that the AI, that ads are going to appear. Kind of felt like that was going to be inevitable.
Yeah.
And then the question of how much is that then going to become another tier where you then have to pay to remove that, which is already happening in streaming. You know, there have been so many streaming apps now that have made you pay to basically remove that ad tier. But that's a big concern, because when you look at Google search, there's been so much pay, you know, ad sponsored stuff that has spammed up search that has made it a lot less functional. And I do worry about that in AI, and we don't even really know what form that's going to take yet. What would sponsored content look like in AI? It does sound like a Black Mirror episode.
Well, that's fascinating and chilling. One last question. So what should we expect from Samsung now? Anything else that you want to tell us about?
Right now we're looking for these phones. If you are waiting for a phone, these are going to be the standard types of models, you know, not folding, probably pretty affordable, ranging in size, maybe about 6.2 inches to 6.7 inches. But I think what's telling, looking through this, is some tech areas are getting a little bit boring. And to me, this looks boring. And if you're really looking for something to show off in a phone, you may have to look for some of those folding options. If you're looking for something more affordable, phone makers make more affordable phones than these. Like Apple has its own more affordable phone series that launches off cycle from the main iPhone, and Google does that too, and Samsung does that. So just as a heads up, you know, they're rolling times throughout the year when you might want to get a phone now. Phone events are not even the main time you necessarily might be shopping for the best deal.
Mm. Let's talk again, Scott. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. Scott Stein is the editor at large, or one of them, over at CNET, cnet.com. Mitch Lyons, the founder of Mitch Lyons Wealth. Mitch, welcome back to the show. How are you?
Doing great, John. How are you?
Were you at a Super Bowl party?
I was at a Super Bowl party. I had my daughter's college basketball team was down in Chicago, and we were hunkered around watching the big game.
Who does your daughter play for?
She plays for Ferris State, which is in Michigan, Division II school, but they were over playing Roosevelt downtown. So.
Oh, how much fun. I mean, my son played a little sports after high school, and I thought that was the funnest thing. You played NFL football. Your daughter is a very good, evidently, basketball player, huh?
Yeah, I have a ton of fun. It's probably even more fun watching your kids play than getting beat up on the NFL field and having to wake up on Monday. So I kind of like watching her get out there and get after it and wake up not sore myself.
Yeah, I was wondering if a guy like you watches a game, any NFL game. You played for the Steelers and the Falcons and wishes you were still back in it, no?
No, like I always say, I miss Sundays. I miss the locker room camaraderie. I don't miss being sore 9 months out of the year. So that part, I don't miss at all. But I enjoy watching games. It's still a great game to watch, and then certainly tuning in on Super Bowls for sure.
You knew Seattle was going to win, right?
You know, I kind of thought Vrabel would have an old teammate of mine in Pittsburgh. I thought maybe they would have a plan to combat Seattle's defense, but they did not, as it turns out. And that was pretty dominant defensive performance by the Seahawks.
Well, as much as we all are so excited about quarterbacks, the chatter I've been hearing since the game was defense is what wins the championship. Is that your attitude too?
Well, it seems to play out that way. And, you know, the Patriots, I think, had the second scoring offense in the league this year. And then they go up against the top defense and they look like they don't know how to play offense at times. So, I mean, Seattle's fast. They're aggressive and physical. And they just took it to them. And New England just couldn't get it solved in time.
We have a number of financial advisors or economists or experts, and they also talk about defensive posturing with your finances. I'm going to segue to that. Are you defensive for clients right now? What's your attitude?
Well, it all depends on where you are. If you're in retirement or approaching retirement, I mean, we need to take measures to protect what you've, you know, spent 30 or 40 years building, right, to get to retirement. So as you're approaching and into retirement, defense is key, man. You got to protect that end zone, which is your nest egg when it comes to retirement.
Yeah.
So we want to make sure we don't lose what we have, and, you know, keep the proverbial blitzers away from your retirement. So, now if you're a little younger and you got a little longer time horizon, that's fine. And retirees should have money in the market too. I firmly believe that, but I also know that first and foremost, we want to secure the income that you're going to need in retirement. And then if that's the case, if we've got that taken care of, you don't need to sweat the ups and downs of the market like we're seeing today. And knowing that your market bucket is, you're not going to need that anytime soon. We can have a little longer time horizon with that.
Yeah, I don't want to describe those people that want to stay in the market, but they're in retirement or near it as greedy. But the market has just been so good the last couple of years, and plenty of smart people think that 2026 is going to be a good year. So, do you get too defensive, or do you stay in the market? How do you help people apportion their assets?
Yeah, again, for us, it really comes down to making sure that you've got the monthly income. That, hey, if you need whatever the number is, $8,000 a month, we want to know that you have $8,000 coming in guaranteed next month, regardless. And that means, hey, I can spend all $8,000 this month, and I know my checking account's going to fill up again next month with another $8,000. My market account might be going up and down, and that's fine. You know what? People need to have money in the market because the market has proven over the long haul that it'll do well. It doesn't necessarily do well year to year, mm-hmm. right? And that's the key. But that's, you know, if you've got a longer-term horizon with that market bucket, I talk about a three-bucket approach. You get your income bucket, your protected bucket, and your market bucket. Income buckets, your Social Security pension, maybe annuity income, any consistent income that we can count on month after month. The protected buckets, the dollars you don't want to lose, you want to have available should you need it outside of your normal expenditures. And then the market bucket, hey, let's be aggressive. If you want, and let's let it run, because that's going to help you defeat inflation over your 30-year retirement.
Do you have a formula for that middle bucket? Like, should I have 6 months of cash needs in that bucket or a year? Do you have a number for that?
Sure. Yeah, that what I call the protected bucket, that's a combination of cash equivalents. And like to your point, I mean, I'd like to have people have, you know, maybe 3 to 6 months of just completely, you know, liquid cash equivalents. But that protected bucket could also be something that has a little more growth upside too, and still have the downside protection, whether that's some sort of structured note or an accumulation annuity where you can still tie your return to the market but not have the market risk, right? And hopefully over the long term still outperform, you know, CDs or a bond portfolio, but still be accessible in a time of need. And so that will fluctuate, you know, based on the client.
Talking to Mitch Lyons, the founder of Mitch Lyons Wealth. Mitch, well, I'll give you the website in just a second. But you've addressed one fear that I think a lot of us have that are approaching retirement maybe, and that is I'm afraid I'm going to run out of money. And then the other fear I have is, okay, I got enough money. Damn, the taxes. I'll end up paying taxes on Social Security and maybe some of my income, right?
Oh, no doubt. People, they get enamored by that 401k statement, right? Maybe you've got $500,000 in your 401k, but you don't really, right? Because you've got a silent partner on that, and his name's Uncle Sam. And here's the worst deal. You don't know how much Uncle Sam owns on that, and you won't know until you take it out because we don't know what tax rates are going to be at exactly. So, you know, one way to combat that is, hey, let's pay the piper now. Let's pay the taxes and do a Roth conversion. People, you know, hear that in the news and papers and stuff. A Roth conversion, what is it? Well, it's taking a pre-tax account and systematically, strategically taking withdrawals, getting the tax out of it, paying the tax, and then getting that money into a Roth IRA where it can grow forever more tax free, and ultimately you can leave it to your kids tax free. And over the long haul, our software will show that in a lot of cases, it's not for everybody, but in a lot of cases, you're going to have a lot more lifetime wealth by doing a conversion earlier than later and getting that money into a tax-free bucket.
Has the trick always been, though, to try and guess when the taxes are going to be high and when the taxes are going to be low? because it depends on the income bracket you're in and also what the administration or state is doing at any point, right?
Well, no question. We don't have a crystal ball. If we did, it'd be fantastic. We could play it accordingly. But we have to play by today's rules. So, you know, we want to be strategic about not taking so much and converting so much that we're throwing you up into a significantly higher tax bracket. But I think the mindset of most people is, hey, we're probably going to see higher tax rates in the future.
Yep.
Across the board. Yep. Due to the, you know, $38 trillion national debt we have. So if that's the case, even though you might be having lower income in retirement, you may not be necessarily in a lower tax bracket. And that's, and I always say, hey, if we run we have our Roth Blueprint software, if we run that for you, and even if it was a wash, you know, whether you kept it in the IRA or you put it in a Roth, even if it was a wash mathematically, I still advise it because now you have control. You're not subject to the vagaries of Congress and future tax increases.
Well, that
you have control of your money.
Yeah, so the money in that bucket is the money you are going to get to keep then, right?
Exactly. And it doesn't matter what taxes are down the road or, you know, you don't have to take RMDs. You don't have to take that money out. And guess what? The best part is what you don't spend, Uncle Sam's not inheriting. You can get that to your kids or your loved ones tax-free as well.
There's no required minimum distribution if it's in a Roth. Is that what you're saying?
No, because the government's already gotten got their tax money, right? Mm. There's nothing to tax there, so they don't make you take the money out. And again, if it's there and you need it, great, you can use it for retirement income, but you know that ultimately you can pass it on to those you love and get it to them tax-free as well.
Uh-huh. And one last thing, because you just mentioned some sort of blueprint analysis. You do a Roth analysis for people, is that what you do?
Yeah, we call it the Roth Blueprint, Mitch Lyons Wealth Roth Blueprint analysis, and it's super easy to do. Basically, it's a brief call just to get the necessary info we need as far as your income, Social Security, that kind of stuff, in order to plug the figures in. And we can run an analysis for you that's specific to your situation. We can jump on a Zoom and just share our screen and show you exactly what it looks like to do it optimally. There's some different factors we can play around with there as we chat with you about it, but it gives you a good sense of what it looks like for you. And does it make sense? Does it not make sense? You know, what is it impacting IRMA surcharges on my Medicare? We can show you all that. We bake it all in.
Okay. I got to go, Mitch. MitchLyonsWealth.com, MitchLyonsWealth.com to get that blueprint, that analysis. There's a phone number here, too, 844-867-8335, MitchLyonsWealth.com. Who do you like in the Super Bowl? No, forget that. How well do you think the Bears are going to do next year, Mitch?
It's going to be interesting. You know, they're going to have a first place schedule, which is going to be a little more difficult. And the fact that they won so many games in the last minutes, right? Well, sometimes that can turn around in a hurry. So I think they're going to be better. Obviously, Caleb Williams has made some progress, and that's going to be something to watch is just what kind of jump does he make from year two to year three. But you know, it's going to be a competitive division, and I think it could really, any of those four teams could come out on top next year, but we'll see. That's why they play the games, right?
Yeah, right. You're right. I think the team will be better, and the coach obviously is good, but we can't count on the miracles.
They lived a charmed life all fall.
Yeah, it was fun.
That has a way of evening itself out over time, but we'll see. They'll have as good a chance as anybody.
MitchLyonsWealth.com, MitchLyonsWealth.com. Thanks, Mitch. Okay, Ted Rossman is a principal analyst over at Bankrate.com. Hey, Ted, welcome back to the show. How are you?
Hi, doing well. Thanks for having me.
Got a few minutes to talk about, well, Valentine's Day and the coupling of people's money. How often do folks share their finances if you have two incomes?
You know, it's really interesting how split it is. Only about one in four couples keep their financial accounts completely separate, but only about one in three completely combine them. A lot of people, 36%, have a mix of joint and separate accounts. And while you need to figure out what works best for you, I actually think there's a lot to like about that hybrid approach, that whole yours, mine, and ours idea, where you combine some money for joint expenses and goals, and then you also have some that's yours and yours alone for individual hobbies and entertainment. And you just need to be upfront about the existence of that account. We don't want secrets.
I think the secret money is not uncommon. If it's cash in a drawer, or I don't know to what extent people go, but maybe they have separate accounts they don't tell their spouse about.
The secrets are a problem. That's what we call financial infidelity. We found almost half of couples don't know everything about each other's finances. And we found that over 40% believe that financial cheating is at least as bad as physical cheating. So if you have that sort of secret debt, secret spending, it's usually better to come clean sooner rather than later, because the secret can really fester. It undermines trust. It can hurt your financial well-being. The secrets are a problem.
I wonder how you apportion the money. Say I make more money than you do. Do I put more in the middle account, the shared account? I wonder how that all works out.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I do hear people doing some of that where it is sort of proportional. Sometimes you have the higher earner paying some of the bigger bills like the rent or mortgage, and then the other person maybe picks up the grocery tab or gas, or, you know, you have to figure out what works best for you. You don't want to feel like someone's on like an allowance or something. You know, that can lead to resentment, whether they have their own salary or not. You just need to communicate. Figure out what works best for you. Boomers are the most likely to combine everything. Gen Zers are the most likely to keep everything separate. Millennials and Gen Xers are the most common to do a blend of the two. But more than anything, we need to get better at communicating about money and just be more open about having these conversations.
So if I buy an expensive purse or a set of golf clubs, that's my money. You don't get to raise your eyebrows. Now, maybe you do, but you're telling me we need to have a roadmap for that to begin with.
That's right. Like, if you and your spouse agree that maybe you each have a certain dollar amount or a certain percentage of every paycheck that's yours and yours alone, that can take some of the resentment out of those kind of purchases. In that case, you've budgeted for it on the front end. You've decided maybe it's $300 a month, maybe it's more, maybe it's less. Other times I hear people saying, well, if it's more than $50, we need to talk about it, or if it's more than $100, or, you know, you figure out where to draw the line, but it all starts with communication.
I know a couple that used to work here, she did, and when they got married, they had a rule like that. I think it was $100 or maybe even $200. You can use the credit card to write a check for anything up to an amount. After that, you got to call me, just as a courtesy, if nothing else.
That can be a good way to draw a line in the sand, yeah, or maybe it is some sort of separate accounts. I would say, though, that completely separate is a bit risky. You know, I would say that whether or not you choose to completely combine everything, your lives are pretty intertwined. You have a lot of joint bills, but also goals. And that's where we need to just work together. Try to frame it in the positive. What are you trying to achieve in the next few years? Maybe it's buying a house or getting out of debt or taking a great vacation. Whatever you're working towards, try to frame your mindset around that. So it's not a budget as a way to deny everything, but rather, what are we working towards and how can we get there together?
Ted Rossman, Principal Analyst at Bankrate.com. Always good advice from you, Ted. Thank you.